Hello, my name is Jim Woods. I'm president and the host today of Diversity at Work Reimagine, your podcast where I help human resources executives, presidents of our organizations, reimagine the impact that diversity can have in their lives from age to class and aspects other than race and nationality. I'm here with our guest today, the Chief Executive Officer of Flywheel Associates, Josh Steele. Hello, Josh. How are you?
Hey, Jim. I'm doing great. Great to be on today.
Man, I cannot tell you how happy I am to have you here. I mean, I got to tell you, it must run in your family because you guys somehow have this way of exuding passion and excitement out of people.
Yeah, I'm trying to keep up with my wife, and that's pretty hard to do. And I think you might be able to relate.
I can relate. Okay, somebody who says about the better half is not joking. Okay, because you humble yourself and say, you know what? I was telling my wife the other day about going on a cruise ship. And so I said, let's go on a cruise. And she said, you realize you're, now I had this dream for many, many years. And she said, you do realize the cruise ship is on water. I had this phobia against open water. And I've been looking at the brochures for a long time and had them around the house and so on. And so she said that it had never occurred to me. I could see the pictures, I could see the water, but it never occurred to me that it's on water. Okay, so she said, you know, some water. And so I gave her one of those looks like deer in the headlights, like, that's a good point. Maybe we have to scrap this cruise ship thing. And so sometimes you have to be humble and admit the things you just flat out don't know or just overlooked. So tell me, my friend, we had a wonderful conversation off air, and you were telling me about some of the things that I hadn't really given serious thought to. I'd heard about it, but tell me about ageism as a form of diversity, because so often we only see it in terms of race or gender, but there's another aspect to it.
Oh yeah, I think we talked about this a little bit. You know, I've had the benefit, at least early in my career, and I can acknowledge that, of being, you know, kind of the right demographic. And that sounds inappropriate to say these days, but it's true. Being, you know, a white male executive, now a middle-aged white male executive. Times are changing. I think we are making progress, but every time we make progress, I like to, you know, kind of refer back to something that Chuck Yeager said, which is, you know, before you break through the sound barrier, you know, the cabin shakes the most. And I think we're going through a tremendous amount of shake right now. And so I guess that's my optimistic view of, you know, we are continuing to progress, you know, in DE&I in all areas. I think one that probably we've made a lot less progress on because we haven't focused on it at all is ageism. And, you know, not to diminish any of the other challenges that we have out there, which are many. But yeah, you know, I think we all, and it doesn't matter what, you know, creed, color, you know, or background you come from, we feel like we've got a window of opportunity and that, you know, there's a certain hump. And then once we hit that hump, you know, we're on the downside. Those opportunities aren't as robust. You know, I know that in my mind, you know, that was kind of 50 and, you know, I'm approaching that very, very quickly. And luckily, you know, I have been putting myself in areas, of work, of thought that have kept me very vibrant and kind of pushing, the boundaries, really not, you know, subjecting myself to one career path or one opportunity, right? We're, you know, kind of taking a multifaceted approach, that helps buffer against some of that fear of aging out. But I know that, you know, for a good portion of my career, you know, I had this impetus to try to achieve so much, you know, in a certain period of time to, you know, create some, you know, amount of wealth, right, to take care of my family and create some legacy, you know, during my youth so that, you know, I wasn't affected by that specter of ageism down the road. And by the time that even came, you know, into relevance, that I was already comfortable enough to not have to worry about it like so many do. But you see it all the time. You see it when you're applying for roles. You see it when you're interviewing for positions. You know, luckily I don't show my age, you know, as maybe others do. And maybe that's because I dye my hair a little bit more than most. But the reality is that it's there. And, you know, so where, you know, maybe we thought that we were discounted because of our youth and inexperience. Now we're on the opposite end of that spectrum where it's easy to be discounted because people don't think that you're capable of learning as quickly, that you're capable of adapting as quickly. They also, and I think this is a big part of ageism, is there's this specter of, well, you've learned what you've had to learn and you've now formed, you know, this person and we want to shape you. So we don't want to bring people in that we know we can't shape. We want to have people that we can mold. And I think that's one of the biggest problems with DE&I overall, which is there's still this idea of we're going to mold you and we're going to mold our culture in the way that we want to, as opposed to truly embracing these differences and this diversity and understanding that even with age, there is a tremendous amount of value and experience associated with that. So, you know, it's a challenge, but, you know, I'm very optimistic that it's one that we'll continue to push the barriers on.
Yes, it is. And I appreciate you saying that. I suspect, you know, I'm a fan, a big fan of history. And I've been reading a book, 1776 by David McCullough recently. Every night I read it, one of his books. I'm reading this one on the Revolutionary War, but it's more to me a book about people than the war. And he breaks it down beautifully about the different human elements. And when I read it, I begin to sense how these very ordinary people had disagreed on so many elements that I suspect that the ageism is something that has always been around. So, you know, old man, get out of the way. We're looking at people. When I looked at my grandmother, she reminded me of Aunt B from Andy Griffith's show. And, you know, grandmothers aren't like that anymore. I don't know if they said that 50 years ago, the grandmothers aren't like they used to be. I don't think so either. But the bottom line is that do you think we're involved in these embedded stereotypes with age somehow that we're expecting people to look or behave a certain way? When I turned 40 years old years ago, I can remember my family putting up the typical gravestones in the front yard, you know, wearing black and so on. He's over the hill. He's going to do this and that. I had them kindly remove it because I didn't want that in my mind, that my body's going to fall apart, that I can no longer run faster, that I can't do this. And that, do you think organizations, not just looking at ways trying to save money with someone who's cheaper and faster, so to speak, but if there's just somehow have these built-in stereotypes of biases, they don't mean to do it. What do you think?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a saying, and you know, the path paved to where is paved in good intentions. Yes. And you know, I do believe, and certainly from my own corporate experience, which is pretty varied, that the intentions are always good. You know, for the most part, the intentions are good, and we're trying to embrace, you know, diversity. We're trying to embrace change. We're trying to embrace all the different, you know, generational attributes that really can come together in a pretty powerful way. But there is inherent bias, without a doubt. There's no question. And it's, you know, I would draw the equivalent as, you know, early in my career, you know, so we're going back a few decades. You know, the fact of, you know, potentially if you were a career oriented woman, and you ended up, getting pregnant early, right? There was, you know, a category that you'd be placed in. And, you know, and so that whole feeling of, all right, I'm slowing my career trajectory significantly by expanding my family. Right. And as a man, I can't fully relate to that. But I remember hearing about it all the time, right? The fear, because I was working, you know, I was in management consulting to start off my career. I'm working with, you know, some of the best and the brightest, you know, people out there of, you know, all genders, you know, creeds, colors, capabilities. And, you know, the women in particular, you know, were really concerned about, you know, that encumbrance. And, you know, I guess at the time it was easy for me to just be like, okay, well, it's something I don't have to deal with. But the reality is we all have to deal with it at some point. And, you know, that's true of the aging process. I think there's always been an intrinsic bias. Again, you hit it on the head, right? The cheaper, faster, and, you know, to the point I was trying to make, you know, much more able to mold those resources when they're younger versus being older. There are a lot of reasons why corporations, you know, invest in that. And they think that's the way of the future. You know, I mean, that's very, very short-sighted. I mean, just look at our population, right? We've got, you know, one of the largest generations, you know, quote unquote, you know, moving into their sunset years, you know, or, and I hate this expression, but I'm going to use it, aging out. And I'd like to turn that around and say it's actually aging in, because you're going to have, and it's already started, a whole new economy, right, created around this super huge generation that we cannot ignore, that is going to have to be a part of the workforce as well, you know, just substantially, because we won't be able to sustain our economic growth if we don't have, you know, people that are boomers, you know, that are in my generation, Generation X, you know, continuing to work past those, you know, normal expected years of retirement. So, yeah, I agree. And I do think that, you know, there is inherent and structural ageism, just as I think that there, you know, are systematic, you know, other examples, you know, of restrictions to certain demographics that, you know, have, again, been baked into the system over many, many years. You know, it's been inculcated. Yes. Because, you know, look, you can go back and you read 1776, you know, I'll speak to another book, you know, which is a controversial book, but it's actually a very good one called The Fourth Turning. And it talks about these cycles that we go through about every 80 to 100 years, where there's this massive generational clash. And that's when the shake, again, is the greatest, right? Not just in this country, but worldwide. And, you know, and that's kind of what we're seeing right now at this specific time in our history. That's what we saw during the Revolutionary War. That's what we saw, you know, during the Great Depression. That's what we saw during World War II. We've gone through these cycles, you know, about every 80 years, you know, where the generations are clashing, because you have the new up and comers, you know, the Xennials and the Millennials, who have a very different way of adapting to their world. And the world is very different than it was for us as we were growing up. And you have boomers and, you know, Gen Xers like me, who may have a slightly different way of seeing the world. And we have a different experiential viewpoint or lens to look through. And that intrinsically creates this clash. And I think that the structure, you know, the structural nature of some of this resistance that we're talking about, you know, certainly with ageism, but with other things, is based on fear, you know, and uncertainty. And as we're starting to age out, right, we're fearful about what that means for us. You know, we're fearful of our relevance, you know, our ability to maintain our independence, our, you know, ability to, you know, be able to interact with the world the way that we want to interact with the world. And so, you know, it's kind of a fear of the incoming youth and exuberance that, to some degree, you know, and a lot of this, I think, is subconscious, we want to hold down, right? It's like, hey, you know, you'll have your time, but, you know, listen to us, you know, we've walked the path. And to some degree, it's not as open to, you know what, just because we've had all this experience doesn't mean we stop learning. And it doesn't mean that these upcoming generations actually don't have something, you know, that can teach us. But in reverse, the older generations certainly have a lot that they can teach the younger generations. And somehow we have to find a way to make those connections. And that has to be a part of the, you know, whole DE&I focus, right? Is how do we take, you know, and I've heard it described as, you know, the intelligence of youth is more of a dynamic intelligence. And the intelligence after we get past a certain age is more of a, you know, quote unquote, crystalline intelligence, which means we don't pick up things as quickly as those that are younger than us. but we are actually able to interpret it through our experience in a very different way than those who don't have that experience are able to. And you need both. You know, you need the mentoring, you need the guidance, you need the experience, along with the youth and exuberance and adaptability. And I think businesses that are truly going to succeed going into the future and have a long-term view are going to embrace that.
That's good. That's really, really good. And it's very relevant. But I'm wondering, Josh, about how, for example, we had an employee years ago, another company where I worked at, and this person was maybe in his 30s, and he had to rush home often during the course of a day to check in on his wife, who had agoraphobia and a number of other items that were wrong with her, relatively young couple. And this took a certain amount of time out of his day, and I can't recall if he was an executive or not. But still, we have people that work for organizations with aging parents, children at home that may need care, and getting someone to come in is price prohibitive. So how does a company relate to those people who are perhaps in the other part of the DEI spectrum, aside from race and gender?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, Jim. And, you know, I'd say you just hit the nail on the head with me, right? You've kind of addressed the sandwich generation, or as I like to call it, the midlife crunch that I'm right in the midst of, you know, with my wife and with a lot of our family members, as we're dealing with, you know, two relatively young children and aging parents who aren't aging as gracefully as we would like. And so trying to support both sides of that equation while managing, you know, two careers, you know, has been incredibly draining, you know, on our collective batteries. And I think that there, you know, is not enough emphasis on that within, you know, corporate structures today. You know, that, you know, we're finally moving in the direction. We've moved the needle in a lot of ways when it comes to, say, something like paternity leave. Yes. Or FMLA, right? Because back in the day, and again, starting out my career, there was no such thing as paternity leave, right? You know, that was something that would reflect poorly on a father if he wanted to take some time off to, you know, help his wife out or be there with his newborn. You know, that's something that's really come into frame of reference much more recently, you know, over the last 10 to 15 years. But we haven't caught up when it comes to, you know, the aging phenomenon and the fact that, you know, man, if we think about it, and we just step back and think about it a little bit, think about one of the most stressful times in your life. You know, I'm living it right now. And that's why we call it, you know, the sandwich generation or the midlife crunch, which is, you know, you've got fires burning on all ends. You know, you're in probably one of the most difficult, you know, family dynamics you can ever be in, especially if your parents, you know, aren't fully aligned on where they want to be as they're aging. And, you know, and you've got to be able to focus on your children at the same time and your career, and what gets lost. Well, you know, the focus on yourself. And are you going to be able to, you know, be the jack of all trades? Heck no, we're human. And, you know, and that means that, you know, you try to be the jack of all trades, you'll be the, you know, the master of none. You've got to focus on the things that, you know, you think you can effectuate the most, but you also need the help of the broader community. And that's where corporations, you know, do need to start kicking in and realizing that if you don't take care of those employees, and they could be at any level in the organization who are dealing with this midlife crunch, their health is going to be impacted. Their motivation is going to be hugely impacted. Their productivity is absolutely going to be impacted. And if you're able to, you know, to obviously support and provide opportunities for them, you know, to take the time they need to focus on, and it doesn't have to be a lot of time, but to focus on, you know, these other priorities in their lives, and, you know, you de-stress, you know, their ability to do so and then fully engage with what they're doing in the workplace, you know, that's going to pay huge dividends long term. And so we need to focus and we need to invest in programs, you know, that support that. And I'll just say that from my own existence, luckily I have my own business, because that gives me the ability to do the things that I need to do to care for myself, to care for my kids, to care for my career, and to care for my aging parents. But man, it is not easy. If I was, you know, subject to someone else controlling my existence, you know, if I was working, as I often have as an executive for a large company, you know, I wouldn't feel the freedom or flexibility to do some of the things that I have the ability to do right now. So I think it's a critical area of concern. You know, I'd be interested in your perspective, Jim, if you think there's, you know, investment going into that area, because I just haven't seen it.
Well, you, as you're speaking, I'm thinking, okay, but how does that relate to, how does it relate to doing the heavy lifting at work and in your families? Then I thought about the benefits of it as well. And that's happening in the aging population. We're right now in Canada and their population is aging. And then we hear in the news the other day about why they want to have so many immigrants, because immigrants, they said, typically have more children. And they also have, younger children, but some of them are younger and they have more children all and bring more vitality as the years go on to the economy nationally. And many companies are doing that, countries rather. And then I began to think about the corollary, the benefits of it. And I remember a man once telling me in Utah about a someone he knew that was very ill and it was ebbing and flowing. He'd get better, then he'd get worse, then he'd get worse as the years went on and they had to keep taking care of him. And then he said he went to bed one night and he had this journal next to his bed, and the habit was that he would always get up and something crossed his mind that he couldn't sleep. He recorded in his journal, and he did it one night, and he wondered, because he kept wondering, why doesn't a man just die? We love him, but why doesn't he just die and be put out of his misery and so on? And then I have never forgotten this, just many years ago. He said, and the thoughts came to his mind that he wrote in his journal, it's not for him, it is for us. Follow me?
I do.
That was the lesson. It wasn't for the man, it was for them to grow in grace, like Covey talked about, for us to grow in becoming a better person, a person we hadn't even thought about that we needed to become. You know, Kevin Cashman in his book talks about leadership, and he talks about the personal persona and the public persona, that we cannot outrun the personal persona, who we are on the inside. No matter how much we try with flashy objects and the titles and the corner office and so on, we can't outrun that. And so your thoughts offline earlier made me think about this in a way I hadn't thought of before, is that this is my last question today, Josh, but how does a company become, they have to be a profiteer in order for these programs to work. That's not a negative term. They have to make money. Otherwise they can't give a charity and so on. But how do they mix that along with the profound empathy they need for younger, older workers or those that are physically, mentally challenged and improving society in the world?
Yeah, and I do want to just reflect back to what you said and bringing up Covey and you know, the fact that this is a journey more about us,
yes,
than it is about supporting, you know, our aging parents. You know, that is an amen in a big, big way, because you know, that is something that I realized through, you know, blood, sweat, and tears over a 10-year period. I think your last question is a great question. I would draw back to, you know, it really rests in leadership. No matter how you look at things, no matter how collaborative, you know, and flat an organization might be, whenever you're building a company, and, you know, certainly a company that's for profit, so much of the culture and the ethos is driven by leadership. And so you have to have leadership that is intrinsically empathetic. And, you know, I can say that that is something that is a big shift that's taking place. And that also is creating a lot of shake for us right now, is that you've got generations starting to move up, you know, the leadership ranks who are inherently empathetic. And maybe their parents weren't, or, you know, their learnings weren't necessarily, you know, all about, hey, leadership equates to, you know, being strong in empathy. I know that wasn't the case, you know, when I was coming out of college and, you know, starting to move into the corporate ranks and move up. And so I always felt like, you know, I was a bit of, you know, a square peg in a round hole, because deep down, I'm a hugely empathetic person. I get that from my mother, who's, you know, she is a quintessential empath. You know, my father's on the opposite end of the spectrum. But, you know, I have had to come to terms with being a part of both of them, a big part of both of them. And, but I tried to hide the sensitivity that I had when I was young. And now I no longer hide it, right? I've kind of grown into myself. You know, it's taken many years to do that. We all have our own path. But realizing that, you know, that empathetic leadership style is actually a superpower. And we need more of that in the leadership ranks, because empathy is actually going to lead us to think about problems with a long view as opposed to a short view. And this gets back to the whole, you know, commercial or consumerist view of business, you know, and questioning kind of our, you know, capitalist ethos, which is, all right, if we're for profit, does that invisible hand move us in the right direction? Or does it move us towards self-interest, and self-interest, which, you know, doesn't necessarily lead us to positive and sustainable long-term outcomes? I think, you know, that there are plenty of great things. I am, you know, someone who believes in capitalism. You know, I believe that our country is one of the greatest countries, is the greatest country in the world. We're going through a lot of challenges, but man, I'm glad we're going through them here versus somewhere else. But it is also a country that was imperfect when it began, and the founders understood that, and they knew that this was continually going to be a work in progress. And, you know, and this is something we all have to buy into. And so leadership, you know, in corporate America is a work in progress. It has to be. And part of that progression is now moving towards, you know, a much more dynamic, empathetic type of leader. And those are ones that can not only relate to their employees, they can relate to their customers, but they can relate to their communities. And, you know, we start seeing problems as shared problems, and we start seeing outcomes as shared outcomes. And I think that actually, you know, from what I've seen, really will exponentially affect the profitability and the productivity of these companies. But, you know, we've got to prove that out over time, you know, by instilling the right leadership.
That is excellent, my friend. Bravo. You know, your ideas are breathtaking, because it puts the, not so much the onus, it makes them in a way that's succinct, that we can recognize, hey, wait a minute, your ideas actually add a human element to it. It takes away the ideas that the company has policies and procedures, yada, yada, yada. But then it puts it back on its, it's kind of like Warren Buffett said, he believes that that improvement requires the individual as much as it does the company. And I love it. What is a good way for people to get involved with you or connect with you guys, Josh?
Yeah, I think you can always reach out to me at jsteele, J-S-T-E-E-L-E, at flywheelassociates.com. You can always reach us on our website at Flywheel Associates. And, you know, I'm always more than happy to, you know, converse with folks that have, you know, questions or observations or learnings that, you know, they feel would be, you know, helpful to, you know, growth, leadership, and obviously how we build towards a much better future.
Well, I do agree with you. You guys are the real deal there. You actually live and breathe this stuff in a positive way of helping everyone, not just businesses, but recognizes that we're dealing with people every day. And thank you, my friend. I'm happy to have you here today. For our listeners, Josh Still, the Chief Executive Officer of Flywheel Associates. I am delightfully honored. Josh, thank you so much, my friend. We will be in touch.
Thanks for having me.
Take care, Bob.
All right, take care.